Hello and welcome to this discussion on the 2020 hurricane season. I'm Louis-Philippe Caron, and with me today is Dr. Phil Klotzbach, research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. Hello, Phil. How are you today?
Hi, Louis-Philippe. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And also with us today is Dr. Ryan Trushelat, co-founder and chief meteorologist at Weather Tiger in Tallahassee, and also hurricane analyst for USA Today Network. Hello, Ryan. How are you?
Hey, LP. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad to have you both here today. So today we're going to review the 2020 Atlantic hurricane season. It was a very busy season. It broke the record for the most number of storms, so there's obviously a lot to discuss. So let me start with you, Phil. Why don't you give us a little overview of this 2020 season?
Yeah, obviously it was an extremely active season. As you mentioned, we set the record for the most named storms in an Atlantic hurricane season on record. We had a total of 30 named storms. Of those 30, 13 became hurricanes, which is the second most on record, trailing just 2005, which is, I'm sure, is a year we're going to hear quite a bit around, quite a bit of the discussion today, comparisons of 2005. Six major hurricanes, which ties for the second most on record, also behind 2005. And also for accumulated cyclone energy, which is an integrated metric that accounts for the frequency, the intensity, and the duration of storms. We had that year, this year was about 170% of the long-term average. So a very active season, but not quite as active as you would think from, say, the overall number of storms. We didn't have any super long-lived storms in 2020, like we did, say, in the year like 2017, where we had a lot of long, we had several long-lived major hurricanes, most notable of those being Irma and Maria. And obviously, too, in addition to just being a very, very active season, I mean, we made it all the way to Iota. We didn't quite make Hurricane Pi for Thanksgiving, but, you know, certainly if you had bet on June 1st in Vegas that we'd get to Iota and that Iota would be a Category 5 hurricane, I think you could have gotten some pretty good odds on that bet. But we also obviously was extremely active from a landfalling perspective. Just in the continental U.S. alone, or the CONUS, we had 12 storms, which is the most on record to make landfall in the CONUS. The old record was 9, set all the way back in 1916. We also had 6 hurricanes make landfall in the CONUS, which ties the record that was set in 1886 and then equaled again in 1985. And obviously, the most impactful of the landfalling hurricanes hitting the continental U.S. was Hurricane Laura, which was a very powerful Category 4 hurricane when it made landfall near Lake Charles. It was also a very, very long-lived storm season. We had 2 storms form even prior to the official start of the hurricane season on June the 1st, those being Arthur and Bertha. And we had 3 named storms and 2 major hurricanes in November, Eta and Iota. So the storm season just kept on going. The longest break at any point during the season with no named storms was only about 10 days. So it was pretty much a nonstop onslaught of storms, even starting before the hurricane season till the middle point of November. We had 10 named storms formed during September, which is the most on record during the month of September. We also had, it was extremely active during the middle part of September. We had 3 hurricanes simultaneously, Paulette and Teddy, which people probably don't remember because those were primarily fish storms, even though Paulette did do some impacts near Bermuda and Teddy also causing some impacts up in the Atlantic provinces of Canada. But obviously most of you probably do remember Hurricane Sally, which was a very, very slow moving Category 2 hurricane that did quite a bit of damage in the Southern United States, making it made landfall in Alabama. And then something that actually the 3 of us are working on, Louis-Philippe, Ryan, myself, and a whole host of others, is how active the late season was. If you went through September, we had 23 storms. So it had been a record-setting for named storms through the end of September, but we had only had accumulated cyclone energy. It was only a little bit above average. So for some of these other quantities, it wasn't particularly an active season. And then we had October and November. We had 7 storms, 5 hurricanes, and 4 major hurricanes in that 2-month period. An average hurricane season gets 3 major hurricanes. So we had 4 major hurricanes just in October and November alone. That's the most on record to form in October, November. No other season had more than 2 major hurricane formations after the 1st of October. If you're talking about ACE, it generated the second most ACE during October and November since 1950, trailing only 2016, which is best known for Hurricane Matthew, which caused obviously a lot of damage in Haiti and then up into the Bahamas and then gave a real scare to Florida and then caused a tremendous amount of flooding up into the Carolinas. And I think kind of one last, you know, highlight of just how active the kind of the whole season was overall, just the storms in the Greek alphabet, so Alpha through Iota, generated enough accumulated cyclone energy, or ACE, to meet the NOAA definition of an average season, which is just kind of mind-boggling. Normally, you would think by the time you get to the Greek alphabet, you know, the season's pretty much done. We had nine Greek-lettered storms in 2020. Overall, I'm just kind of highlighting just how active the late part of the hurricane season was in 2020.
So basically two seasons into one.
Exactly, yes, yeah. So really, I mean, the season had been really active through September. For a lot of metrics, for ACE, it had been above normal, but not to that really high level. And then October and November just kind of took 2020 to another level. And obviously we'll get into a lot more detail as we dive further into this discussion.
Yeah, right. So we had 30 storms. So if we keep this podcast to an hour, so that's about 2 minutes per storm. We're going to have to be, very efficient. So there's obviously lots to discuss. Ryan, since we're not going to spend times on each of these 30 storms because we don't have time, could you give us maybe a rundown of the biggest stories of this 2020 season?
Sure. Whenever you're talking about a hurricane season, you know, looking at it from an overall activity perspective is an academic way of looking at it. But where the rubber hits the road is impacts, and impacts on the continental United States are obviously something we're very focused on. Living here and just the amount of people and buildings that are on the U.S. coastline is heavily populated for most of the Gulf and Atlantic coastline. And this was an unrelenting year of high impact tropical cyclone activity over the continental United States. There were 12 named storms that hit land, including 13 overall landfalls, because Ada hit twice in November. It was unbelievably active from the beginning of the year to the end of it. You had two systems in May before the official beginning of the hurricane season, Arthur and Bertha, that both required U.S. watches and warnings. And then Ada, the second to the last storm of the year, was actually the first to make landfall in Florida. And we had hurricane warnings up in the state through mid-November, basically. So just beginning to end, there never was a part of the season that was quiet from a landfalling perspective. And in fact, the first third of the season, June and July, third in calendar terms, not in expected activity, there was actually more U.S. landfall activity in the June and July than there would be in a median hurricane season overall. And then that was also true for October and November, again, exceeding the median of a normal season, just in, you know, basically in a third of it. So it was almost three hurricane seasons in one. And in fact, if you look at the overall net amount of tropical cyclone energy that occurred over the continental United States, so we say that there's 180 ACE units occurred overall in the Atlantic. And of those, about 13 and a half of them occurred near or over the continental United States, which is about, you'd expect to see that about one out of every 20 seasons. So that's about a 20-year return rate for that. And that is an amount of landfall activity that was greater in 2020 than all the hurricane seasons between 2009 and 2015 combined. So in some sense, it was seven hurricane seasons in one, if you're looking at a kind of period of time where there weren't very many landfalls. So you had Louisiana was the hardest hit. Five named storms hit Louisiana, including a Category 4 hurricane. Portions of Louisiana spent three or more weeks in a National Hurricane Center forecast cone from multiple storms. Sometimes Louisiana was under multiple cones at the same time, as in with Laura and Marco. The entire U.S. coastline was under at least a tropical storm watch at some point, other than just a tiny section of the Florida Panhandle, very close to where I live in Tallahassee, actually just south of here. So I lucked out. I had to work my tail off forecasting for these storms, but I was fortunate to not experience any adverse weather this year. Hurricane Laura is the headliner storm of 2020, caused about $20 billion worth of damage, impacting southwestern Louisiana late in August, just south of Lake Charles. wind gusts in Lake Charles were over 135 miles per hour. It destroyed the radar, the National Weather Service radar out of Lake Charles, just shredded the radome there, and they're rebuilding it from scratch, essentially. Terrible wind event, wind damage event for much of western Louisiana, including well inland. If the track had been just a little bit further west, it also would have been a significant storm surge event for Lake Charles. And but fortunately, the winds out of Lake Charles were basically out of the east instead of out of the south, that would have driven more surge up the bayous there. One thing about Lake Charles, if I'm, you know, I'm very sorry if you're a resident of southwestern Louisiana, you had an exceptionally difficult year between Laura and then you had Hurricane Delta about 6 weeks after Laura. They hit basically the same place, within 15 miles of the landfall point as a Category 2 hurricane. So that's a terrible year for southwest Louisiana, but southwest Louisiana is one of the more sparsely populated sections of the Gulf and Atlantic coast. So there wasn't any, you know, while we had many hurricane landfalls this year, there was one major hurricane landfall as a Category 4, and we didn't have landfalls in major metropolitan areas. So overall damage, $40 billion, but you didn't have that showstopper individual storm like a Harvey or a Katrina or an Irma that, you know, individual storm doing 70 billion dollars of damage or more. The flip side of that coin is that Central America took it on the chin, especially late in the season with Hurricanes Eta and Iota. You had a lot of twins this year in the Atlantic. You had a lot of systems that kind of followed a previous storm's track. That's true for Laura and Delta. Unfortunately, it's also true for Eta and Iota, which Eta peaked out as a Category 4, Iota peaked out as a Category 5. And they made landfall basically in the same place in Nicaragua, and then proceeded westward across Central America. Extremely damaging flooding event. You know, the worst flooding event for South or for Central America since Hurricane Mitch in 1998. You know, and hugely damaging, and especially to have a two flooding events 3 weeks apart when Central America was still recovering from Eta, to have an equally, if not stronger, storm right after was a terrible thing to watch. Another, just in terms of impacts, staying on that theme, rapid intensification was very common in 2020. You had 10 named storms with rapid intensification events, which means you had 35 miles per hour increase in sustained winds within 24 hours. And many of those rapid intensification events occurred on the way or up to landfall. And that's even, you know, particularly across the U.S. Gulf Coast. Laura plateaued right before landfall, but it was intensifying for 36 hours up to that point. You had Zeta rapidly intensifying up to landfall in late October, which is just unprecedented. Hannah was intensifying to a high-end Category 1 when it made landfall in Texas in July. So in terms of impacts, those rapidly intensifying events, they carry wind damage further inland when they are strengthening at landfall because of the greater kind of instability of the lower atmosphere indicated by the intensification. So this is a very bad year overall for, you know, obviously busy from start to end, but in terms of U.S. impacts, you know, what we really care about, just an extremely busy year. And the only thing I can point to is something we're fortunate is that these 13 landfalls did not predominantly affect large metropolitan areas.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I want to just jump on these on what you were saying about rapid intensification. We had a lot of these events late in the season, which was quite unusual. We had five in October and November, and I think that's never happened before. Is that correct, Phil?
Yeah, that is correct. And I think really kind of what stands out to me, again, this paper that the three of us and some other colleagues are working on is, you know, if you look at rapid intensification, that's usually, as Ryan mentioned, it's 35 miles an hour or more in 24 hours, and that's considered rapid intensification. But if you look in 2020, in October, November, we had three storms that intensified by at some point in her lifetime, 75 miles an hour or more in 24 hours, which is just a mind-boggling amount of rapid intensification in October, November, those three storms being Delta, Eta, and Iota. The only, and prior to 2020, the only intensive storm in October, November that intensified at that much was Hurricane Wilma in 2005, which is the all-time record holder for intensification in a 24-hour period, about 110 miles an hour. Should point out, rapid intensification is something prior to the satellite era, so prior to the mid-1960s, we probably didn't observe as well, so we probably missed some of these high-end rapid intensification events prior to that, but still to have three events in 1 year and then to have only one event, say, the prior 50 years shows you just how kind of turbocharged the late season was. And just from a landfall perspective in October, November, we had five of the seven storms in October, November made landfall. And in this paper we're working on, we identified 10 separate landfall events of those five storms, most notably Eta, which made landfall in Nicaragua, then in Cuba, and then did two landfalls up in Florida, again, kind of getting, at least paying Ryan at least somewhat of a close visit late in the season. So just obviously just in a very impactful year from a landfalling perspective. But as Ryan noted, we didn't have any major hurricanes or any strong hurricanes hit major metropolitan areas, both Cameron Parish, where Delta and Laura made landfall, as well as where Hannah made landfall in Kennedy County, very low population counties. So these storms, while causing tremendous amounts of damage where they made landfall, didn't impact high population centers.
Yeah, and you know, and Florida really was the you know, the high risk part of the U.S. coastline that just was almost entirely skipped this year. The exceptions were, you know, Eta made landfall as a tropical storm twice in Florida. I was on the dry side of that one, so it was truly barely anything. And Hurricane Sally made landfall technically in Gulf Shores, Alabama, but Pensacola was in the eye wall of that one, and some portions of the Western Panhandle received up to 30 inches of rainfall. So, you know, an impactful event on the periphery of the state, but Florida was quite fortunate. And one other thing I want to point out for the late season, this truly, unprecedented amount of activity occurring after October 1st. The normal number of major hurricanes that forms after October 1st is zero. That's the median in the past 70 years, so since 1950, about almost 45 of those years, there has not been a major hurricane after October 1st. And there had never been more than two, like Bill said. So he had to have four, there's no precedent for that.
Yeah, one thing I was going to say is, so our group at CSU, we forecast five major hurricanes. And I remember doing an analysis in late September and looking at these climatological statistics that Ryan just gave, and, you know, thinking, okay, there's no way we're going to hit the major hurricane number. We're going to be too high. And then to actually end up being too low, certainly very big surprise to me, because again, you know, it hadn't happened before. And obviously, my old mentor Bill Gray was a huge fan of climatology, but as my dynamics professor once told Dr. Gray, there's no climatology in the vorticity equation. So every now and then, if the conditions are just right, you can get a lot more. You can get more storms than you've ever experienced, and that's certainly what happened at the end of 2020.
There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in climatology, to repurpose some Shakespeare.
Very true.
Even for a La Nina year, you know, if you restrict to, say, moderate La Nina events, you would still only expect one or two major hurricane formations. It's not, you would expect probably at least one, but you wouldn't expect four.
Yeah, like you mentioned, quite unusual. These three storms, Delta, Iota, and Eta, they went from tropical storm to Cat 4 within 48 hours.
Yeah, and I mean, just all of these storms. I mean, one of the things that I always look at just kind of as a first cut whenever I see, you know, the National Hurricane Center start advisories on a storm is the SHIPS model, which is basically just statistical output of kind of a large scale environment forecast by the models for a specific storm. And you looked at Delta, Eta, and Iota, and I mean, it was like sea surface temperatures of 29 degrees plus Celsius, so 84 degrees plus Fahrenheit, which is basically rocket fuel, very, very low levels of vertical wind shear. So the change in wind direction with height is pretty weak. So the storm can basically blow up and build these big, strong thunderstorms, plenty of moisture. I mean, just these ideal environments, which you do find on occasion, but not usually one storm right after the other. And to me, especially impressive was November. Ida and Iota getting two really powerful hurricanes, a high-end Category 4 followed by a Category 5, going pretty much doing almost the exact same track, making landfall in almost the exact same place. And it's amazing what nature can do if you give it the right environment.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Caribbean didn't know that it was November. It had just been a long time since we had late season activity with the long residence time in the Caribbean.
Yes, definitely, it was quite an impressive send off to the 2020 season. And as we mentioned a couple of times, all of us are working on a paper on this topic that we'll hopefully be submitting to the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society in the next few weeks.
So Phil, you hinted at this a little bit, but maybe you could explain why this season was as active as it was.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. And, you know, for the 2020 hurricane season, and we'll talk more about the seasonal forecast in a bit. If you look at the seasonal forecast, pretty much everybody forecast a well above average season, even from early April, and then even increases in June and August. In general, the named storm predictions, obviously beating most groups, I don't think any group forecasts 30 storms. Overall, you know, the large scale conditions certainly favored an active season, and that's what we got. You know, many of the kind of the canonical factors or the factors that you normally associate with active hurricane seasons were there. We had very warm waters in the tropical Atlantic and the Caribbean, and we generally had lower than normal vertical wind shear, especially in the eastern Atlantic, so right off the coast of Africa. And then in the western Atlantic, as you would expect, given how active the western Atlantic was, we have very low shear for parts of the season, most of the season in the Gulf of Mexico and especially in the Caribbean. Normally, when you have a La Nina, which is colder than normal water in the eastern and central tropical Pacific, that tends to lead to lower vertical wind shear, especially in the Caribbean. And we certainly saw that this year. And then I think another thing that really stood out was we had a very active West African monsoon. And if you look back at the research that my mentor, Bill Gray, and some of his students worked on, basically, when you have a very, very active West African monsoon, it tends to mean that these African easterly waves, which are these strong thunderstorm complexes that move off the coast of Africa, tend to be more organized, and those are more likely to develop into tropical cyclones. The zonal vertical, if you look at the vertical wind shear average across the entire tropical Atlantic and Caribbean from August through October, it was the lowest on record, going back to the late 1970s when the data becomes more reliable, especially in the Western Caribbean late in the season. The vertical wind shear was especially low, and that tends to be what kills your season. Towards the end of the season, your vertical wind shear tends to increase. You get more frontal intrusions into the subtropics and into the tropics, so it tends to really increase your shear. This year, the Caribbean especially was kind of sequestered. The shear was much lower than normal. Looked like we had basically September shear in October, and even in November, the shear was just extremely low. You know, to have shear of 5 to 10 miles an hour over a cyclone during November is extremely low. And when you look at kind of the large scale average over the Western Caribbean, it was the lowest on record during the month of November. So hence, combined with the very warm water, certainly provided very conducive conditions there. I think there was tended to be a fairly strong area of low pressure at upper levels in the atmosphere in the central Atlantic, which tended to kind of shear a lot of these systems coming off of Africa. So if you had asked me prior to the season, you know, is it going to be an active season? I'd say yes. And I would expect a lot of systems coming off Africa to develop and take these long tracks, more like what we saw in 2017 with Irma, Jose, and Maria. And we had a lot of storms forming off Africa, but most of those storms, with the exception of Teddy, just got sheared and didn't make it across. Basically, if you look at most of the significant hurricanes of 2020, they really didn't ramp up until they got to about at least 60 degrees west longitude, at least fairly far into the central Atlantic. There tend to be a little bit higher shear in the central Atlantic, which I think tended to knock down and kind of eliminate these long track systems coming across.
I was just going to say that reminds me of 2005 too, because in 2005, if you look at the track density, it was all in the Western Atlantic, and it was Katrina, kind of a predecessor depression to a kind of TD10, then a DD10 open to an open wave, and that wave came into the, you know, came into the Western Atlantic and reformed as TD12 over Bahamas, and then the rest is history with Katrina. So again, like, you know, that's another pattern that it may suppress those long trackers. You didn't get an Irma, you didn't get a Maria, but you know, but you did have quite a bit of activity. When you allow the waves to follow the lower level steering flow, the trades that are blowing from east to west, and you let those seeds get closer to the continental U.S., you have a year like 2005 or 2020 from a landfall perspective.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, and again, so normally if storms form right off of Africa, typically those storms, a stronger storm tends to track a little more north of due west as it moves across the Atlantic. So those are storms are more likely to either say hit the East Coast, but more often actually just recurve out into the ocean. Hurricane Irma is kind of the quote-unquote exception that proves the rules. Bill Gray would say normally storms forming right off Africa are less likely to hit the U.S., but obviously if systems are forming at 60 degrees west near the islands or even farther west, those storms, there's really no place for them to go where they're not going to hit somebody, whether it be the United States, the Caribbean, or the Gulf of Mexico. But yeah, I think you're right in that there are a lot of similarities between 2020 and 2005, both of them very active wave seasons, but the systems really didn't ramp up until they got farther west. And when I was looking back at the 2020 season, we had 13 hurricanes. And the only one that you could say basically formed completely, probably with no wave help, was Epsilon, which formed from a non-tropical area.
That's remarkable. Gosh, I hadn't actually gone and looked at the Genesis pathways, but yeah, wow, that's really something.
Yeah, I'm a little unsure about Sally. I hadn't quite, 100% convinced myself. So you can have storms that kind of form completely from non-tropical, like Epsilon, you have like completely classic tropical. But I mean, the fact that we had two hurricanes form from waves in November with Eta and Iota, that's just not common. So just the wave season was really amped up from start to finish. And like you said, the conditions weren't super conducive east. So the storms that formed east kind of died out and the waves that just kind of kept on trucking got to the Western Atlantic where conditions were super conducive. And then we obviously had really high impacts. And the steering flow also to kind of the mid-latitude flow tended to be characterized by higher pressure along the East Coast, which tend to kind of help push the storms farther to the west.
Right. We have very persistent ridging over the state of Florida and then the southwestern Atlantic over the course of the year. And that really, to the detriment of Louisiana, it protected Florida for almost the entire season. And it also, of course, being, north of the Caribbean, allowed there to be a lower shear environment that remained in the Caribbean late into November, which is also, it's a fairly stronger Western Atlantic ridging. And it's also something that goes along with the development of La Nina, but we'll get to that.
Well, we can get into that now, actually.
Sure. Yeah. So that's a good point. Yeah. So La Nina played a dominant role in driving a more active than normal Atlantic hurricane season. Before the season, as Phil and I were putting together our first whack at making seasonal outlooks around April, late March, we were coming off of a weak El Nino last winter. But there were indications that we were going to tip into cool neutral or even La Nina conditions over the course of the hurricane season. And that makes a big difference because if you look at historically the ENSO state, El Nino, La Nina, and just as a review, I don't know if you would have made it this far in the podcast if you didn't know this, but in the equatorial Eastern Pacific, El Nino is warmer than average waters and La Nina are cooler than average waters. The average Atlantic hurricane season, even with a weak El Nino event, is about 20 to 25% less active than usual. And a weak La Nina is on average about 25% more active than usual. So that makes a big difference. And we did see cooling over the tropical Pacific through the course of the summer and into the fall. Officially, we had onset of La Nina conditions as determined by NOAA in September. We settled into a moderate La Nina event where sea surface temperatures were about a degree Celsius cooler than normal late in the year. So the pathway by which that influences Atlantic hurricane seasons is reducing the wind shear or the changing of the intensity or direction of winds as you go up in the atmosphere. And the convective thunderstorm activity that sustains the heat engine that drives tropical cyclones, it operates more efficiently when those winds are fairly close to each other at different levels of the atmosphere. So the atmospheric response for this development of the ENSO was pronounced. And again, as Phil mentioned, the beginning of the hurricane season, the onset of the first storms is controlled by sea surface temperature, basically. You're not gonna get a Category 5 hurricane developing in May. There's simply not enough potential energy in the tropical oceans. Maybe I'll eat my words on this 50 years from now or something. But for now, you can't get a Category 5 in May.
Yeah, it sounds like you're tempting fate right now.
Yeah, I don't know why I would say that. but basically, you just don't have enough heat potential in the tropical oceans in May, or even, you know, in the early, very early part of the hurricane season, to have extremely strong tropical cyclone activity. So the onset is controlled by sea surface temperatures, but the end of Atlantic hurricane season, there's still plenty of heat energy out there. As you can see, when Category 5 develops in the Caribbean in November, the water has a high thermal inertia. It takes a lot to heat it up, and it takes a lot to cool down. So you don't lose, heat energy very easily out of the warm waters of the tropics. The control on the late season is wind shear. So the fact that we had this moderate La Nina develop over the course of the hurricane season really kept those wind shear values across the Western Atlantic, the Gulf, and the Caribbean significantly lower than normal than they would have been otherwise. And that, coupled with a steering regime that allowed systems to develop in the Caribbean and then move northwest and then north towards the U.S. Gulf Coast, made for a high impact latter third of the season.
Phil, is there anything you'd like to add to what Ryan was saying?
Yeah, no, I think Ryan did a good job. I mean, basically, the fact that the La Nina was strengthening as we got into the late season, it basically just really helped kind of create just a very low shear environment that really kind of exacerbated the late season, and also with the combined with the very warm waters that we had in the Caribbean helped kind of create this kind of low level, almost gyre-like or spin-like, low level cyclonic spin area in the Western Caribbean. So when these systems got to that region, they really tend to spin up quite quickly. And like we talked about earlier, normally La Nina does load the dice towards an active late season because of the shear response. But this year is even more than kind of the normal La Nina response. And I think that was combined with the fact that the Caribbean was extremely warm. And also just some of the, basically just a combination of the warm Caribbean combined with the La Nina, like they help kind of keep the season going, rocking and rolling through the middle part of November.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we got punished with some mean reversion here, because it's just, if you look at the entire decade of the 20 teens, on average, tropical cyclone activity was 25 to 30% above normal across the Atlantic basin. But those increases were not uniformly distributed across the Gulf, Caribbean, and the open Atlantic. The biggest gains were across the southwestern Atlantic, essentially the kind of the box between Bermuda and the US East Coast. The subtropical Atlantic saw a significant gain. The MDR, what you call the Cape Verde kind of pathway, around normal activity, but the Gulf and the Caribbean actually came in a little bit below normal, especially the Caribbean. You just hadn't had a long residence time storm in the Caribbean for a very long time. Michael developed in the Caribbean in 2018 and Nate in 2017, but they quickly moved out. And in the tropical oceans, a lot of the heat removal of how you cool down tropical oceans and how do you cool down the Caribbean? Well, tropical cyclones do it. You essentially evaporate water off the surface, and evaporation cools, and you upwell cooler waters from depth. So the fact that we hadn't had a Caribbean hurricane of a long residence time, especially in the central and western Caribbean, you had Matthew who moved across the eastern Caribbean in October of 2016, but the western Caribbean just hadn't seen a strong hurricane almost since, 2010. So I think we've mean reverted. I think there was just a lot of extra heat potential in the western Caribbean that just, in the same way that if you haven't had a forest fire in an unmanaged forest for a long time, if there's a spark, it's going to go up in a conflagration. And I think that's essentially what we saw in the western Caribbean.
Yeah, one last thing I was going to point out about that. I remember looking at the sea surface temperatures in the Western Caribbean in early October, right at the time Gamma and Delta formed there, and you were looking at sea surface temperatures. The area of greater than 30 degrees Celsius or 86 degrees Fahrenheit was phenomenal, and there were a surprising amount of areas of water greater than like about 88 Fahrenheit, which is just effectively rocket fuel for storms. And so there was a lot of basically energy for these systems to tap, and unfortunately we had active waves. We had a lot of waves still trucking across into that region, combined with low shear and that rocket fuel, and we saw the result.
And earlier you were mentioning, you know, the late part of the season that got very active. So usually when you have, you know, a lot of activity within the season, considering within the season, sometimes the MJO has a role to play. So is it the same this year?
Yeah. So the MJO was a little bit messy this year. So basically the Mann-Julian Oscillation is strong thunderstorm activity that propagates around the globe about every 30 to 70 days. And it's not kind of like a lot of things in weather, it's messy. It's not always very strong. So sometimes you don't really have Mann-Julian Oscillation activity. But when it's fairly robust, what ends up happening is you end up changes thunderstorm activity and also changes levels of vertical wind shear, which obviously we've talked about a lot already on a seasonal time scale, but it also alters vertical wind shear, moisture, things like that on a sub-seasonal time scale. So basically what we look at, if you're looking for active periods in general in the Atlantic, is when the Mann-Julian Oscillation, or MJO, is located over Africa in the Western Indian Ocean, when you're getting strong thunderstorm activity there, it tends to reduce levels of vertical wind shear in the tropical Atlantic and Caribbean. And so if you look at, I was looking at it through the season to try to kind of diagnose how much of an impact it played. And I think in late August, it was playing somewhat of a role. It likely kind of helped reduce some of the shear conditions that made conditions favorable for a little bit for Marco, but certainly more for Laura, which was in a very fairly low shear environment, a nice favorable anticyclone aloft too. You know, when I look back in mid-September, the MJO looked to be fairly weak. There was a lot of kind of just the La Nina-like basic state during that time, so just kind of the overall forcing from the La Nina, which also tends to create, reduce the shear over the Atlantic. I think we had a fairly potent MJO, it looks like, that may have helped stifle Atlantic hurricane activity during the middle of October. So after Gamma and Delta, we had Epsilon in the subtropics, but in the tropics, it kind of got quiet for about 2 weeks. And I think we had some strong thunderstorm activity that tended to maximize over the Pacific, and that tended to actually increase the shear during that time. But then as the MJO continued to propagate farther eastward, it kind of, you had the La Nina effect, which is reducing the shear, and then you probably had a more conducive MJO, especially during early to mid-November, that probably created conditions that allowed Eta and Iota to reach those really high intensities, and they did. Oh, and also too, getting on that, you know, something that Ryan's pointed out before too, which is nice, is that basically if you get, so the MJO is a sub-seasonal activity. And so the Atlantic hurricane season is extremely peaked. The canonical hurricane season peaks around September 10th, but you get half of all your hurricane activity in the month of September. So if you can get the Mann-Julian Oscillation basically in phases 1 to 3, which is over effectively West Africa into the Indian Ocean, during the climatological peak of the season, you can really, really ramp storm activity up a whole lot during that time. Whereas if you get favorable MJO conditions, say earlier in the season or later in the season, if it doesn't quite sync up, you want to try to sync up the MJO with the canonical seasonal peak to get kind of your quote unquote best bang for your buck.
You know, and yeah, I think the timing was pretty close to what I would consider, you know, would be considered ideal for positively contributing to an active season. Now, despite the 10 named storms in September, September didn't really run up the score with ACE simply because it only Teddy really was a long tracking major. But, you know, you definitely lined it up with Hannah and, you know, Hannah and Isaias in late July. There was this kind of, you know, push through late July and early August, and then you were quiet in mid-August, and then you saw the ramp up. You know, the Eastern Pacific was just dead this year. It was, you know, there's this kind of inverse relationship between how active the Eastern Pacific is, which tends to be quieter in La Nina years, and the Atlantic. And really the only time that the Eastern Pacific lit up was right before Laura and Marco developed. And that was something that as a forecaster, someone who writing columns to help people understand when there's going to be a threat, I could point to that and say, look, you know, the Eastern Pacific is lighting up. This is going to be us in the Atlantic in, you know, 10 days or 14 days. And, you know, unfortunately, Laura was the headliner for the season. September was messy, you know, MJO from an MJO perspective. But and then there was definitely some predictability later in the season, you know, active in early October, quiet in mid-October, and then active again in late August and November.
Bill, anything else you'd like to add about the MJO?
No, that's about it. I mean, I think, again, there was a lot of, you had also the basic state or the background state of La Nina. I think that sometimes there's kind of this one index that is usually used to kind of estimate the current location and intensity of the MJO, and as soon as the Wheeler-Hendon index, since because it was put together by Matt Wheeler and Harry Hendon. But that index sometimes can get kind of contaminated by the basic state, especially when you have a strengthening La Nina like we did this year. Because if you look at the kind of the MJO propagation just from that one index, it basically looks like it was stationary and strong for about 30 to 40 days. And that was more probably just the overall developing La Nina. So you have to kind of try to, there's a few other things we can do to kind of try to figure out what the MJO was doing. But I think, like Ryan said, it was a bit messy this year. It wasn't the most straightforward MJO analysis when I was trying to put together our seasonal verification and tying it to the MJO. Certainly, like Ryan said, you know, you did see kind of this nice periodicity in Atlantic hurricane activity that probably was at least somewhat tied to the MJO.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely, you know, as Phil's hinting at here, now, we basically had over East Africa and the Western Indian Ocean, a persistent area of unusual rising in the atmosphere, a rising branch of the Walker circulation. And that is something that's linked to generating the seeds, the African easterly waves that down the road become, you know, tropical storms and hurricanes. So when you have just one area that doesn't move and convection is favored in that area, it can make MJO analysis messy. So that's, you know, but certainly the standing branch, the rising branch over the Western Indian Ocean was that's how you get 30 named storms with, you know, relatively little contribution from, you know, baroclinic origins.
Let's move on to talking about the forecast, actually. This year, the seasonal forecast did actually quite well. I mean, the first forecast that we got tight at the end of March and in April were indicating a busy and active season. And that being said, it was a bit of an odd one to forecast because some indicators were quite high. So if you just look at the number of storms, you get 30 storms, so it's never happened. But then if you look at the ACE, well, ACE was high, but it was not record breaking. So, what about you, Phil? How did you perform at CSU?
Yeah, like you said, it was an odd year to forecast. I don't think anyone's going to forecast 30 storms and an ACE that we got of 180. And so, the kind of the metric that we target with our seasonal forecast is ACE. And then basically, what we do is we then forecast kind of the breakdown that you normally get when you get an ACE of a specific amount in terms of the number of storms and hurricanes. But we did call for an active season from early April, which is our first outlook. We predicted 8 hurricanes in April, 9 hurricanes with our updates in June and July. And then we went up to 12 hurricanes in August, which I thought was, you know, a really, really kind of gutsy forecast and really high. And we ended up breaking that too. We ended up with 13 hurricanes. But certainly we did not forecast 30 named storms. We did go up to 24 named storms in August, which was the second most on record, had that verified. We'd obviously already had quite a few named storms by then. I believe we had already had 9 storms, but certainly still didn't think we'd have quite 30. And like Ryan said, the thing that was impressive was a lot of these storms that we saw in 2020, they were from waves. We had some kind of these baroclinic or storms that form outside of the tropics, but most of these storms were from waves, which is quite impressive. The forecast for ACE, I think were reasonably good. We didn't do Weather Tiger. We didn't forecast ACE on the number like they did. They definitely get kudos for that. But we did forecast 150 ACE in April, 160 in June and July, and 200 ACE in August, and we ended up with 180. Just to put that in perspective, because I know it's kind of hard to, you know, look at that number and know what the heck that means. An average season has just over 100. So, you know, a forecast of ACE of 150 is well above an average season. And again, we ended up with 180. I think in general, you know, things kind of played out the way we thought they would in terms of the La Nina, but it got a little bit stronger than I thought. I think I was looking back at our forecast. We were saying, you know, cool, neutral, maybe a weak La Nina. As we've already talked about, we were actually to moderate La Nina by the end of the season. So, you know, that moderate strength La Nina was something we didn't anticipate. The big reason we upped our forecast from our July outlook to our August outlook was that large-scale conditions during July were extremely favorable. And there's a lot of what's known as persistence. So basically, if conditions are a certain way in July, they tend to behave that way in August and September. And so we had very warm waters, extremely low vertical wind shear. And so when we did our early August forecast, we upped stuff quite a bit. And it was interesting. I was looking back today just on the statistics of our views on our website. Normally, The April forecast gets probably about twice as many views as the August one, but because our August forecast, we increased the numbers to 12 hurricanes. I'd have more views than the April one. I think it just definitely got people's attention. And obviously, you know, the season, I don't think it quite played out the way we thought it would. I think we would have expected more storms coming off of Africa, developing right there and going all the way across like we saw in 2017. But certainly, you know, I think the overall extremely active season was pretty well forecast, both by our group at CSU, obviously by Ryan's group, and then by most of the other groups that contribute to the seasonal forecast website.
Well, I think you just found the perfect way to increase traffic on your website, Phil.
he'll do anything for the clicks, you know? Yeah. Obviously, that's not true for listeners. That's the opposite of true.
So Ryan, I remember last time we talked, You said, I asked you like, what's your forecast for the season? And you said, this year reminds me of 2005. Yeah. So, I mean, you did see this coming.
Right. Well, we did well, as you know, we're very close to the consensus or the average of the seasonal forecasts that were submitted to seasonalhurricanepredictions.org. Our April forecast was for ACE, median ACE of 145. I think our 50% range was somewhere between, I don't know, 75 ACE and 200 or something, because April forecasts don't have that much skill. You know, we were looking at the likely development of a La Nina, as, you know, as Phil was. Our ENSO model got pretty aggressive with developing a moderate La Nina by the time we issued our June outlook. So we increased our forecast ACE to 180, and we kept it there for August. For both of those, our 50% range, where we think there's a likely is not to fall within that range, was right around, you know, 150 to around 210. So that 180 number, you know, if you're just going to pull one number out of our forecast, we did get exactly 180 ACE, but you can't skillfully forecast with that kind of precision. We like to see numbers that are towards the center of our, you know, of our confidence interval, and certainly that happened this year. But I don't want to give anybody out there the idea that you can forecast, you can put that fine a point anywhere near that fine a point on the seasonal forecast. So yeah, the 2005 analog was one that came up quite a bit. It was something that came up it was the best match for taking, for example, our August forecast. Our weighted analog regression algorithm basically weighted the 2005 SST analog. Where are the SSTs that matter the most going forward from, you know, early August onward, if you're looking at July sea surface temperatures? And basically 2005 was the best match for that. I think the real difference between this year and 2005 was that you didn't have July be extremely active in the Atlantic. And the reason why the Atlantic wasn't extremely active in July, you know, the only thing that separated this year from the 200s of ACE was significantly drier air than normal over the Atlantic in July, which means you didn't have a Dennis or an Emily like you did to rack up 60 ACE units in July. But drier conditions, there's actually no statistically significant correlation between drier air across the tropical Atlantic in July and going forward for the rest of the season. Like Phil, you know, we're looking at zonal wind anomalies in July, and those tend to persist, you know, into August and September, the peak of the season. The trades were weaker than normal. That means lower shear. That means conditions were likely to be favorable, you know, going forward for the rest of the year. So, you know, that's something that we were looking at. We didn't change our forecast that much between June and August, because our assumptions that we made in the June forecast kind of played out, and there wasn't a whole lot to add. It did progress basically as we expected once we got through. And so it's more difficult to forecast in the spring. There's small perturbations and weather scale disturbances can kind of tip Pacific into a neutral or El Nino or La Nina in a way that's very difficult to predict. So once you get past April and May, you start to have better forecast skill. So, you know, that's why Phil and at CSU and myself at Weather Tiger, why we increased our numbers from April to June, and then they stayed elevated as our assumptions were met over the course of the summer. So warm Atlantic, La Nina, we were able to say there's about a 2/3 chance that this season is going to be hyperactive, which is ACE of 160 or more. And these La Nina years, we also were able to people off that this is probably going to be a late shifted year. So be very careful. Don't book, well, no one was going on a cruise in October of this year, but we wouldn't have advised you to do so anyway in the Caribbean. So, you know, these La Nina years, they do tend to be late shifted, especially Nina onset years.
So, Phil, is La Nina also the reason why you steadily increased your forecast from April to August?
Yeah. I think, you know, so we did, our forecasts were similar to Ryan's, but we did do one final bump up in August. And so, yeah, I think the original bump up from April to June, July was due to a lot more confidence in the La Nina coming on. And then I think the last bump up for us was basically just how conducive July was. Like Ryan said, we didn't have any long track major hurricanes in July, like Dennis or Emily, to give us a bunch of ace. But overall, the conditions looked extremely conducive, and you know, stuff was just starting to kind of ramp up in such a way that it did look like things were really shifting, you know, more towards the active. And so we do, I was just looking back at the analogs we picked for 2020 with our August outlook. And so we had six analogs, and there were 1966, which was a little bit above normal, but the other 5 years were 95, 2003, 2005, 2010, and 2017. And that was, you know, quite a list of analogs to use. When you have 95, 2005, and 2017 in your analogs, your things are pointing towards a really active season. And yeah, I mean, I think obviously that really bore itself out this year. Although again, kind of Noah talks about this too, you can have very active seasons, but they can break down very differently. And so, you know, you can have a year like this year where there was just so much, this past year, there was so much quantity of storms where we basically just kind of brute forced our way to an extremely high ace. Whereas you can have other years like 2004, 2017 had 17 storms, but ended up with 225 ace because we had very long-lived intense storms. And we had three huge ace generators that year in Irma, Jose, and Maria.
Right. I mean, a single storm, it's important to note, can do up to 70 ace units, I think I think Ivan holds the record for that. I could be wrong, but you know, certainly 50 to 70 ace units is not impossible for a single long tracking Cape Verde type storm. I think Irma was above 60. So, you know, obviously, you know, when you're talking about, you know, literally a third of your possible verification, even for a hyperactive year, is dependent on one storm. I mean, going back to 2019, you had just a handful of storms generating 80% of the ace, and then 80% of the storms generating less than a fifth of the ace. It was mostly Dorian and Lorenzo. So, you know, that's why we put, you know, confidence intervals. That's why we use exceedance or chance of exceedance for ace as Phil and I communicate our forecasts, because, you know, individual storms and weather scale influences can have a huge difference on how the final number winds up.
Yeah, and you can think, I mean, obviously, even in the case of Dorian last year, you know, just how very subtle things kind of allowed that system to, you know, ramp up and develop. And, you know, had things changed slightly differently in the storm track over Hispaniola, as opposed to going to the east, had the center not reformed, you know, there were some shear impacts, things like that, like very subtle changes. Had Dorian not, you know, been a nothing storm and gone to Hispaniola, you know, we could have had 40 fewer ace in 2019, and instead of an above normal season, you'd be talking, you know, a near average season. And again, that's why there's noise in seasonal forecasts. That's why you'll never, even with perfect knowledge of the large scale environment during the season, there's always going to be noise in how much storm activity actually occurs. And that's just because of, these are weather systems you're trying to forecast on a climate time.
Right. You only get one 2020. You don't run it 1,000 times and see what the probability distribution is of what it would have looked like, you know, starting from, you know, those initial and those boundary conditions. We make the seasonal forecasting enterprise, we do our best to turn that into a forecast of a range of outcomes that are plausible, but we'll never be able to tell you, you know, a storm will form here in 2 months, or there's going to be exactly this amount of ace or exactly this number of storms in an upcoming season. It will never happen.
Well, you did it this year, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was luck, obviously. I mean, it was luck to get the exact number, but I don't want to set that bar higher than I can possibly hit. So I'm trying to reset folks' expectations of Weather Tiger forecast products going forward.
So let me conclude by the question that I ask every time at the end is, is there any valuable lesson that you take away from this particular hurricane season that you could apply for future seasons, starting with you, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, we learn a lot of stuff. And, you know, I said several times, the three of us and others are working on October, November. And I think there's still, hopefully, even between now and a couple months from now, we'll learn more about, you know, what exactly makes these seasons so active. Ryan and I both, at least I think this is Ryan's first year. This certainly was our first year where we did probability of exceedance calculations to kind of better quantify the uncertainty associated with the outlooks. So we've always kind of had error bars, but these kind of a little more rigorous statistical methods to better quantify just how much uncertainty there is. I think one thing I learned, and I think my wife could attest, I was really fretting in late September. I thought the forecast was going to be a bust, that our ace was way, way, way too high, because it was late September and things that kind of, you know, were kind of quiet for a few days. And I thought, oh man, this season, you know, it's not behaving the way that I thought it would. And then of course, October, November were just bonkers. And I think that people like to make judgments on hurricane seasons by mid-August. And you have to realize that so Dr. Bill Gray used to ring a bell every year on August 20th, signaling the active part of the season. So really the hurricane season, while it goes for 6 months, it really is peak between August and October. Obviously this year went into November, but I think this year was kind of a return to some of the really older years where you had a lot of activity late. And I think, you know, we had kind of been accustomed to seeing even years like 2017 that was so active, October, November was pretty tepid. So just kind of like Ryan's kind of reversion to the mean and a lot more storm activity late in the Caribbean. And so, you know, just kind of see if that is something new going forward, but obviously something we're going to be looking at as we start moving from talking about 2020 and looking ahead to 2021, which is, you know, not too far away to start thinking about seasonal forecast for next year.
Yeah, that late season track out of the Caribbean towards the Gulf Coast is a very common climo track from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, but it's just not something you see a whole lot of past the early 60s, honestly. I mean, you have like Irene in 1999, and Nate in 2017, obviously Michael in 2018, but, you know, certainly you weren't seeing the frequency of those kind of late season events, you know, out of the Caribbean that you did in the earlier half of the 20th century.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, a lot of when we do our modeling and stuff, you generally, you know, you're trying to use the better quality data and everything. So a lot of, you know, when I'm doing statistical modeling, a lot of it doesn't even go back maybe to the, sometimes go back to 1950, but oftentimes just the last 40 years. And so you don't have those. But if you look back, in the 1930s, you had the Cuba hurricane of 1932, which is an extremely long-lived Category 5 from late October through mid-November. So you have seen, you know, 1932 actually had more ace in October and November than this year or 2016 by a decent amount. And that was mostly just due to that one storm. So you have had these really active late seasons in the Caribbean. And like you said, heading up towards the Gulf, but it just hasn't been as canonical of a track in recent years. And so we'll have to see if this is kind of heading back more towards that kind of a climate pattern coming up.
Right. And that 1932 November hurricane, that's the only other Category 5 occurring in November in the climatological record. So there's barely a precedent for some of this out there in climo.
So Ryan, let me ask you then, is there something, a lesson that you're taking away from 2020?
A couple of them. You know, I'd say that this year really underscores, this was our first year of communicating the forecasts in terms of ACE, in terms of exceedance, and communicating forecasts probabilistically. And I think that that's a really important thing to focus on going forward. Rather than getting too bogged down in exact numbers of how many tropical storms, how many hurricanes, you know, because the observation platforms have changed with time. I think we probably would have missed your Vickies and Wilfreds, you know, even in the 1950s or 1960s, were they out there. So communicating, I think, probabilistically gives people a better sense of, you know, where to focus their attention and how to best prepare. So I think, I guess lesson one is, I think the outcomes this year, I think, really validate communicating forecasts probabilistically, and that really be the right way to communicate to the public. I think the other thing that you just have to think of going forward is, I mean, Phil and I think are both coming at this question of seasonal forecasting first and foremost, I think, is tropical cyclone climatologists. I mean, that's what our research is primarily in. I mean, at least myself, I'm not a dynamicist. You know, I have the B minuses in dynamics to prove it. But, you know, it's unfortunate that we simply don't have a long enough climatological record to have the entire universe of things that are possible occur in the climatology. So, you know, looking at October and November, you know, Phil and I are both a bit shackled by just the data going into the model in terms of identifying years that had likely similar outcomes. You know, you identify some precursors, and then what happened in those years? Well, you had two major hurricanes, you know, in a year where there was a moderate La Nina. Okay, great. There's probably going to be one or two major hurricanes in October. Well, surprise, there's four. You know, and I think it just you're not ever going to get the full range of possible outcomes out of climatology, either at the seasonal level, you know, or really at the individual storm level. And these rapid intensification events that happened over the course of the season, I feel like the NHC really got more aggressive with their intensity forecasting as the season went on. They were a little more conservative, I think, towards the beginning of the year. And then with Iota, advisory number one, when Iota was a depression, was calling for it to be a category four. So, which I think was the most aggressive NHC intensity forecast going out to 96 hours ever, or one of the most aggressive. So forecasting, just the general practice of it, it's all about learning. It's all about getting a sense of what's possible and trying to communicate the possibilities. So, you know, it's very possible that with climate change, we're not necessarily even drawing from the same sample set of, you know, kind of the background sample of like what would happen if you ran 1,000 hurricane seasons. The future may not be like the past for that. And I think it really points out kind of the need to continue to adapt and continue to push forward on dynamical seasonal modeling, as well as incorporating some of the way that maybe, you know, skating to where the puck is going as much as you can from a statistical or climatological perspective. It's a tough question. You're always going to miss the extremes, and 2020 was nothing if not a year of extremes.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it. Before I let you guys go, let me just thank Phil. You can find the CSU seasonal forecast at www.tropical.colstate.edu. And you can find Phil on Twitter at Phil Klatsbach. You can also find Ryan on Twitter at WX_Tiger. Ryan, would you like to say a few words on Weather Tiger?
Sure. Well, again, LP and Phil, thanks for a great discussion. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk shop and hopefully give people who are curious a little more background on what happened in 2020 and how we make our seasonal forecasts and kind of try to continuously improve them. Weather Tiger will have our first outlook for the 2021 season out in about 3 months. So look for that in early April. You can find that at weathertiger.com. And we also offer an email subscription service where you have access to all of our seasonal forecasts that we put out through the course of the year, as well as basically weekly updates within hurricane season, outlooks going out to 10 days and our analysis and discussion of that. And then when storms are developing, we put out forecasts once or twice a day to our email list. So if you're interested in getting Weather Tiger's take on both the season as a whole, as well as individual threats over the course of the year, go to weathertiger.com and click on register. So thank you for the opportunity to plug.
Thank you, Ryan. Phil, do you have anything you want to plug?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks again for having me. And thanks, Ryan, too, for joining. This has been a great discussion. Yeah, we will also be doing our first seasonal forecast in early April. We also do sub-seasonal forecasts. So during the peak months of the season from August to October, we put out two-week forecasts every 2 weeks. And I can tell you that while I spend a decent amount of time on the seasonal forecast, sometimes agonize over the two-week forecasts. And especially I remember one in late September, just agonizing over the forecast, because it looked like the Western Caribbean should get active, but the models were kind of all over the place. And then a couple days later, Gamma formed and then Delta formed. And it looked a few days later like that was shooting fish in a barrel, should have been an easy forecast. But the day we put it out, it wasn't as easy as it looked a couple days later. So definitely check out our website if you're interested in seasonal forecasting, sub-seasonal forecasting. And yeah, like I mentioned before, the three of us and some colleagues are working on a paper on the late season, October, November, 2020. And hopefully we'll get it out to submit it to a journal and hopefully get some good feedback from some colleagues on that in the next few months. And perhaps maybe even by the end of the year, it'll be formally published. It just takes a little while to get papers through the submission process. So we'll see how that goes.
All right. Thanks, Phil. Yeah. So this conversation is coming in a bit later than we intended. And this time it's my fault. So I guess we'll meet again very soon, probably to discuss the 2021 season. Yeah. I'm curious to see how this is going to go. So before I let everybody go, just a reminder that you can find all seasonal hurricane forecasts for the Atlantic at www.seasonalhurricanepredictions.org. So thanks again to Ryan and Phil, and talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.